Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vatitamastu Mahivishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Verse 5. Avicharakrito bandha, avicharakrito bandha, vicharena nivartate. Tasmat jiva paramatmanau, tasmat jiva paramatmanau, sarvadaiva vicharayet, sarvadaiva vicharayet. Avichara krittaha bandaha vicharena nivartate. Tasmat jiva paratmanau sarvada eva apas as I for a sense, but new sense it seems. Sarvada eva vicharayet. Okay. Avichara krittaha bandaha. Banda, bondage. So bandaha, bondage. Avichara krittaha, which is brought about, which is caused, which is produced or is an effect of avichara, the lack of vichara. I'll talk about vichara in a moment. So bondage, which is caused by the absence of vichara, avichara krittaha bandha, vicharena nivartate, it is destroyed, removed, eliminated through vichara, by vichara, by means of vichara. The bondage, which is caused by avichara, by the lack of vichara, by the lack of analysis, is removed, destroyed by vichara. Tasmat. Therefore, jiva and the paramatma, jiva paramatma now, is in the accusative dual. So the jiva and the paramatma, which is Brahman. So the jiva and the innermost self, which is desha kala vastu aparichedaha, not limited by time, space, or quality. So the jiva and the paramatma, sarvada eva. Eva is an emphasis, indeed, always, at all times, sarvada. Always, indeed, always, vicharayet. One should contemplate, one should do vichara upon them, upon the jiva and the atma, and the paramatma. There should be vichara. So let me just start by talking a little bit more about this word, vichara. If you look it up, it'll say analysis, investigate, something like analysis or investigation. the study, when we're in Vedanta, when we're talking about vichara, we're talking about shravana, manana, and in a sense, nididhyasana. So let me remind you what we mean by shravana, manana, nididhyasana. There's some important understandings there. The first is that shravana manana nididhyasana is really what we call the upaya nishtha. This is the direct, immediate means for gaining self-knowledge. So this is the vichara. The analysis is really complete through shravana and manana, and then it is owned up by nididhyasana. So let me translate shravana manana nididhyasana, but somebody doesn't know. Shravana means listening. Listening to the Shastra as unfolded by the teacher. Listening to the Upanishads, listening to the Vedanta Pramana, the means of knowledge that we call Vedanta, which is really an unfoldment using certain, what we call prakriyas, certain methodologies to unfold the meanings that are contained in the Upanishads. So the shravana is listening to and understanding the vision as it is unfolded in the Upanishads. Now the Upanishads are also themselves expanded upon and unfolded in what we call Prakarna Granthas, their explanatory texts. Panchadashi is like that. It's an explanatory text. Tattva Bodha, you know, is the title of a text. One, sometimes the first text that Swamiji teaches, it means Bodha, knowledge, Tattva. Tattva Bodha, knowledge of the truth. That's an initial text which really goes through and expands all of the kind of the vocabulary of Vedanta, and then all of the concepts, making you have that kind of total container of everything that's being really talked about and unfolded in the Vedanta. You become familiar with it. There's another explanatory text, Prakarna Granta, there's many, but Atma Bodha, knowledge of the self. That's by Shankara, that goes through a very systematic unfoldment of the vision held in the Upanishads. The vision held in the Upanishads has to be the knowledge in a Prakarna Granta explanatory text has to be true to the vision of that is held in the Upanishads, or it's not a Prakarna Granta. It's not an explanatory text. It's something else, right? But not something that we would ever use as an explanatory text of the Vedanta. So it's an exposition that dilates and expands for you to see with depth more clearly everything that's said in the Vedanta. So these are called the Prakarna Granthas. The Brahma Sutras are kind of the final text that is ever studied, and that's an analysis, a very, very thorough analysis of the vision that is held in the Upanishads, and also the Shravana. So the Brahma Sutras will give you the Shravana in great detail, using Purva Paksha Siddhanta argumentation, presenting an opponent's position, and then answering it from the like say a Sankhya. The Sankhya position would be answered by the position of the Advaita Vedanta. So it goes into tremendous details, kind of traditionally the way these things are handled in the darshana system. And so that text also is considered part of the Bhagavad Gita, Prasthana Traya, the three pillars of the Vedanta, really the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Brahma Sutras, and all of the Prakarna Granthas. These explanatory texts are something which are useful to the student, you know, for really understanding those. So when we talk about vichara, the two main aspects of vichara are the unfoldment, the teaching of the vision of the Upanishads, using also Prakarna Granthas, so that in Shravana you really see, you understand and you see, you know, and have doubts, all doubts removed in reference to what the vision of the Upanishads themselves. That's a type of vichara, just understanding, seeing, recognizing the vision of the Upanishads. Manana is another type of vichara where we're answering the doubts about the veracity of that vision, the truth of that vision. Because a student can kind of have a clear idea of what the Vedanta is saying, but then have a lot of doubts about why couldn't it be this way? Or this is what the yoga is saying. This is what the different Baudas are saying. This is what I'm saying, you know, which does not, myself, I mean, as the one that's a student, why can't it be like this? That's, manana answers that. Why can it not be like this? Either going from the standpoint of another darshana, or another philosophical system, or another spiritual discipline, why can it not be like this if the ultimate knowledge of that particular school of thought or in your mind is not Advaita, is not non-dual? He said, why would this not be true? Why couldn't this also be true? Why can't this be true and this also be true? Mm. Or why can't this be true and this false? Mm. And they're saying things that are actually opposite. Now, this type of vichara is centered on knowledge, not centered on belief. It's centered on knowledge, you know. And so the doubts regarding the vision of the Upanishads themselves have to be answered so that you know what the Upanishads are saying. And the doubts regarding why or why not that vision is correct have to be answered also. And so you have to have, in for Vedanta, and actually this is true for other darshanas, it kind of exists within kind of the Hindu culture, that freedom to, the absolute freedom and respect to questioning, not being afraid of your doubts, questioning them and staying with it until a particular doubt resolves. Nobody can make it resolve for you except you. And it will resolve for you by your tenacious, you know, staying at it until you get it, until you see it. If you never see it, if you don't see it, that's going to be like a boulder, you know, in terms of your vision. It's something your mind will always be knocking up against. And so the knocking up against deserves to be respected and resolved. That boulder is removed. Sometimes we use the example of let the knowledge itself just moves like the wind without any type of obstruction. You know, it just freely moves. It moves through space without any type of obstruction. If there's an obstruction there, then that's like a boulder. That's something, you know, to be dealt with, to be resolved. And so vichara has to do with the teaching methodologies to convey this vision. So what we call vichara. If analysis it's not a thorough word, good enough word. So the teaching methodology is to actually give you the vision, and then also the vichara has to do with the removal of all of your doubts around that vision. So shravana, manana, that's manana, the removing the doubts around the veracity of that vision, that knowledge. And nididhyasana is the contemplation, the owning up in meditation of the knowledge, the things that you've recognized. Now, not just intellectually, things that you've actually recognized at the time of teaching. The nididhyasana is sitting with that, contemplating upon it, being with it, getting to know yourself, contemplating upon Ishvara, understanding the Paramatma as the very being, the very being of Ishvara, recognizing, contemplating upon the mityatva of the creation in such a way that I sit with it in terms of seeing it rather than analyzing it. Analyzing it is the vichara of shravana and manana, just to put it in two big groups. Nididhyasana is sitting with it in such a way that I can own it up. Another way of saying it, that I can get used to myself. Because I'm not used to myself. I'm only used to myself through the lens of the mind, you know, or through the lens of the body. I'm not used to just me as I am, ever the same, ever abiding, not being a knower, but being the knownness which all experiences, all vrittis enjoy. Mm-hmm. Owning that, being with it, my buddhi falling in love with my own being as its very self, its very home, it's kind of its sacred sanctuary. That is really facilitated by nididhyasana. Nididhyasana also is considered very helpful for removing the dehatma buddhi, because for beginningless time, the self, because of beginningless ignorance, beginningless ignorance just naturally takes the mind, naturally takes me to be one with the body, mind, sense organs. So that ahankara, that natural identification with the body, mind, sense organs, which has been going on from beginningless time, does not just drop off. And even to have a recognition of that, I really have to understand intellectually, that satya-mitya relationship. I have to understand that, and then I have to see it. I have to own it. And nididhyasana is beautiful that, for that. The dehatma buddhi doesn't mean that the misidentification. Dehatma buddhi means the conviction, the buddhi, the conviction that the atma, the self, is the body. The subtle body or the physical body, there's a deep conviction. It's such a deep conviction you don't even know that you have the conviction. You just take that for granted. You know, so it's almost an unconscious conviction. This is me. This person is me. And so to recognize in the totality of the subject-object experience that I'm having at any given moment that the ultimate subject is my own being, you know, is my own, the own conscious being. And that it always remains naturally differentiated from the object in terms of satya mitya once I recognize myself free of that. And so nididhyasana is very, very helpful for that. So here it says, the bondage, which is really the beginningless identification with the dehatma buddhi, with the body, mind, sense organs, that is absolutely natural from the standpoint of the mind, that agnanam is there, and at the same ignorance is there, and at the same time, my mind is not away from me. Right? It's just the example we use for this to show just how wonderful this superimposition is. It's an incredible thing. If you think of the clay pot, a clay pot, the pot is mitya, right? The pot is mitya because it has no independent being. It really, really the only thing that is there is clay. So we can even, this is what I was talking the other day, we can actually say that the pot is asat, that it has no existence, because it doesn't. The existence it has is the clay, right? So the pot has no existence, and yet it is experienced. That's what makes it mitya. If it was like the so-called son of a barren woman in the days when that was a possibility, in those days, and that was a possibility, that's asat, absolute non-existence. Mitya is also, both are non-existence, the pot is non-existent because the only thing there is clay, but it is experienced. That makes it mitya. That's why we call it mitya. It's 100% dependent upon whatever is the satyam. 100%, it has no being of its own. That's what makes it mitya. We experience it, but it has no being of its own. Asat, in terms of what we call tucham. Tucham means absolute non-existence. There is no experience of it. There can never be an experience of it. It is not there. That's tucham. So in the Shastra, you'll find sometimes asat is used for mitya, because we have the experience without the existence, because the existence only is Brahman. You know, is the satyam. And sometimes we're talking as asat as an absolute non-existence, which itself doesn't exist. What we're saying doesn't exist. Absolute non-existence doesn't exist. So we use actually this concept of something which is not there to be experienced in any way whatsoever as a border between, here we have satyam, absolute existence, absolute being, which is never not there, versus absolute non-existence, which is never there, never experienced. So here you have satyam, here you have asat tucham, absolute non-existence. And in the middle, we have the whole universe. Everything that exists within time and space, everything that is subject to change, coming into being and going in, out of being, that is what we call mitya. It has no being of its own because it comes from non-existence and goes into non-existence. Non-existence is not there, so nothing can really come from it. And yet we experience this creation, and trying to find the source of it is like going into an infinite regress. You can't find the source of one name and form. It just breaks up infinitely to other names and forms, and other names and forms, comes into being and goes out of being. All of this. So you can't establish any existence or any there for it, but you experience it. That's mitya. So you've got satyam, pure existence, which is never negated at any time, which is ever present as sat chit, limitless sat, limitless being, which is consciousness. It's never not there, never changes in any way. absolute non-existence down here. And in the middle, everything else, everything that can be experienced, can be objectified, that comes into being and goes out of being, is what we call mithya. Right? So this whole creation, every experience that you have, your body, your mind, your sense organs, your emotions, the ahankara itself, ajnanam itself, everything falls under the category of mithya, because it is subject to removal. Ajnanam is subject to removal. Ignorance, via knowledge, you can remove ignorance. The means for dispelling ignorance is knowledge, you know. And all of the names and forms that we experience, all of the vrittis, all of the emotions that come into being and go out of being, they're all mithya. They exist when they are there. But the existence, if I say they exist, what do I really mean? Is that when they are there, they are enjoying my existence, my being. You know, just like an imagination, like a dream, when it is there, you know, it is. Because I am. Its isness is really only my amness. It has no independent existence at all. And so here, this is, when we say this, what we call this bondage, bondage itself is caused by avichara, avichara kritaha, bandha. Bondage is caused by the lack of vichara, the lack of teaching, which is as well as saying it is caused by ajnanam, self-knowledge. Ajnanam, self-ignorance. It's caused by self-ignorance. And self-ignorance, like any ignorance, is only removed by knowledge. And here, the knowledge takes place by vichara. And the vichara, in reference to the Upanishad, in reference to the Vedanta, is shravana, manana, and nididhyasana, in the sense of owning up what you have discovered, recognized at the time of vichara, that owning up is through the nididhyasana. So the vichara, shravana, and nididhyasana. Okay. So that bondage is there when there is no vichara. Another way of saying the bondage is there when there is still self-ignorance. So as long as there's self-ignorance, there is going to be bondage. Right? And it says then, vicharena nivartate, that very bondage that is caused by self-ignorance is removed by vichara. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. The shravana, manana, nididhyasana is the vichara, which gives the analysis, the means which removes the ignorance that is causing this experience of bondage. So actually, if you think about it, everything that you take yourself to be is bound. Your body is bound. Desha, remember the desha, kala, vastu, paricheda? Your body is bound by time, it's bound by space, and it's bound by quality. What are you going to do about it? That's it. It's bound by birth and death. It's spatially located. It has a short time span to live. Yeah. And it's bound by the qualities. The very qualities that it has are limited qualities. So it is bound by nature. Right? And so, how are you going to free yourself from that? How will you free yourself from that, the bondage of birth and death and change, where there is nothing, there is not even any type of experiential state that will last, any type of vritti? Mm. Vritti by nature will change. It has to change. Imagine your vritti, all of a sudden, you know, it's like a tape. You know, the tape gets stuck. Mm-hmm. It keeps rolling along and rolling along. Okay. Like a snapshot, like your mind freezes. That would be really disastrous. Okay. The mind's not like that. It's continually vritti after vritti after vritti after vritti, experience after experience after experience after experience, internally and externally. That is the situation. And so there is no constant here. There is just a continuation on every level of birth and death, of change. You know. And so where is there any moksha in that? Where is there any freedom in that? In that? So we say that bondage is the very nature of the upadhi. It is bound by its nature in terms of desha kalavastu paricheda. It's bound by time, it's bound by space, it's bound by quality, by its characteristics. So if you are that, then you are bound in terms of the definition, our definition of bondage. You are bound by that. Right? What are you going to do about it? Even knowledge is not going to help you. I mean, if that's the truth of who, what you are, not knowledge, mm-hmm. your knowledge will just affirm that. But yes, you were right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You are bound. And if you are bound, so your knowledge, no knowledge is going to help you because it'll just substantiate the fact that you are bound. And also, what can you do about it? You know? You can do yoga and eat brown rice, as Swamiji would joke, and do everything you can to extend, you know, the life. Or to follow Dharma. In fact, in the first part of the Vedas, we would say, and which carries over to the second part of the Vedas, in terms of relative shanti, the best you can do in terms of your mind is follow Dharma. For relative shanti, that is the best that you can, but is still relative. And you can still make a little slip up, a little dharma here and there. And it's like a bouncing ball, you know, into agitation. So that's not freedom, because you can't just relax and say, okay, all is well with me, all is fine, and there's nothing I can do about it. Nor can anybody else do anything about it. That's what we consider moksha. Mm-hmm. I will not suffer, I cannot suffer. In fact, my nature itself, you know, can't change, is free of time and free of space and free of attribute. It's the desha kalavastu. Free of time, free of space, free of attribute, and yet I am the Paramananda, the Advaya Paramananda, as it says in the verse. So if I am that, but I take myself to be this, then what has to happen is we need a means of knowledge to reveal my nature. My nature, which is not, it's not as though it's not fully present as me. It's just that seen through the lens of the mind, my mind takes this myself to be itself, and itself, the mind, is bound. My mind takes myself to be my body. Right? My body is the conscious being, and so therefore the conscious being, me, this me, will die when the body dies. My mind takes itself, it takes me, myself, to be it. And therefore, my happiness is very, very, very tenuous. Because the mind and the unconscious can throw up all kinds of things. With the raga dveshas, with my likes and dislikes, with trying to create and hold on to these shantavrittis, these moments of happiness, you know. It's a losing battle. It's a losing battle, very tenuous. And you can't control it either. You can't say, let me be happy now. Let me be happy, you know. Or how about, okay, I'm not going to be depressed anymore. That's over. I'm not going to have deep, dark emotions, you know, coming up from my unconscious and overwhelming me. I had enough of those now. It's over. Nope. No. Not like that. But in terms of within the relative world, there are ways of being with those things that are very helpful. But it's still, we're being very helpful within the relative world.
Yeah.
You know, with attitudes that can really bless us and help us to withstand, you know, all of the changes that we are going to go through, whether we want to or not. But nevertheless, as long as there's an identification based on ignorance with that which is continually changing, there is no really way to just be. And say, all is well with me. Where I don't have to perform some sort of an action or some sort of a correction. Yeah. Do something to bring things back into order. There's no such thing. Because all of these instruments I'm talking about, these instruments of change, these instruments of aid, all themselves exist within time and space. And so we're always having to maneuver, take care of things. And we can take care of things and make things relatively okay, especially with a commitment to Dharma, but only relative. And you have to stay on your toes. You know? So then we have to say, well, moksha requires continual management. I've got to manage my moksha. Do not have to manage your moksha. You know, first of all, that moksha, which does not require any management, itself has to be free of change and free of time. Yeah. So I have to discover my free self. That discovery has to be made. If it's not there, we're stuck. But if it is there and I don't know it, it requires vichara. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana means of knowledge. It requires a means of knowledge. So that my mind, my buddhi, recognizes the truth of myself. It has to recognize it. It has to recognize its own mithyatva, even the buddhi. It has to recognize its own mithyatva, its own state of being mithya. Right? And being mithya, it has to recognize the self. You can't, something's not mithya unless it recognizes its own adhishtana. And I am that adhishtana. I'm a different order of reality. For me, there is no time. There has never been any time. I am the eternal presence. The presence with a nitya. Nitya means eternal, has a sense of going on forever. This is the nityatvam. Nitya means I am free from time. That means this me that I am right now, I will always have been, always will be, because I am timeless. I am the self that is present at any one of the infinite creations that have become manifest, and in any one of the bodies or any of, and all bodies through all times, I am the one that is the being and the self of all of those bodies, the being and the self of Ishvara. My being is the timeless reality that is ever present. But I have to recognize that by differentiating myself from these things, that I have had this, what we call anyonya adhyasa, this mutual superimposition, where the mind takes itself to be me and then therefore takes me to have all of the qualities of it. So the mind is me, and I am, you know, agitated and angry and sometimes happy and sometimes this and sometimes that. I have limited intelligence, I have this, I have that, I have this. Whatever quality of the mind has, that's my quality. The mind takes the body to be me, and therefore the body in which the mind is located, as though, is the conscious being, and the body, therefore, since the body is the conscious being, me, this me, since the body is me, therefore, I am subject to birth and death and old age and illness and infirmary and all of these things that are natural to the body. That is what is natural to me. This is what we call a mutual superimposition, where the body becomes the conscious being, and therefore the conscious being takes on all the attributes of the body. The mind is the conscious being, and therefore the conscious being, me, has all the attributes of the mind. This is called anyonya adhyasa. So this is where two things are appearing as one, are taken to be one. The example they use in the Shastra for that is the red hot iron ball. Mm-hmm. Say you don't know fire and you don't know an iron ball. You've never seen them separate. So somebody comes up with this red hot, you know, bright red because of the heat. Red hot iron ball. Amazing, you know. It's just one thing. It's a red hot iron ball. That's what it is. Iron has the qualities of tremendous heat and redness. brilliance. That is the quality of iron. And this red, hot brilliance is very weighty and round. This is the mutual superimposition. They take the characteristics of each other, right, as they're viewed as only one. Now, how to separate that? Staring at it? I have to actually recognize fire as fire and red hot and iron ball as iron ball. I have to recognize the two, which means in Drishtanta illustration like this, actually I have to pull them apart somehow, you know, and put them back together. I kind of have to do that here internally, even though I can't take my body and go, you go over there, and okay, conscious being, you go over there, now we'll see what each one is. Then we can bring them back together. But we do kind of do that. We do kind of do that because conscious being is changeless, you know, and it is me, and it is ever present no matter what the objectifiable experience is. That is the pulling them apart, that recognition that, when I have this, say, I'm aware of this thought, okay, say I have a thought, I'm aware of this thought. Yes, I'm aware of this thought. This thought is in my awareness. Next thought. That thought's gone. That's just a fact. Right? I have this thought, I'm aware of it. That thought's gone. I have the next thought, I'm aware of that. Next thought, still aware. Next thought, still aware. Next, is the awareness anything happening to it? No. Still aware. Still aware. Still aware. Nothing's happening to me. Nothing's happening to me. Nothing's happening to me. And yet, these experiences are coming into my consciousness, going out, coming in, going out, coming in, going out, here for a moment. Nothing happens to me. Now I can differentiate. Look, nothing happens to me. This is just one viveka. It's one type of discrimination. I recognize that no matter what the experience, I'm there. What the emotion, I am there. And now I start to focus, well, let's focus on the one who is here. And notice that I never change. That's one prakriya, that's one type of viveka that we ask, that we kind of guide the mind into a recognizing. When we do the drip-drisha viveka, the seer-seeing analysis, that's another prakriya, that's another teaching methodology that helps to, you know, separate the fire from the iron. Separate me from the objects of my awareness. The objects of my awareness come and go. Even emotions, all of them. Doesn't matter what it is, there's no exception. Anything that comes into my awareness is objectifiable. Awareness is not objectifiable, and it need not be objectifiable, because it is consciousness itself. It is its own self-evident me. So the meanness, the conscious being that I am, is kind of the baseline, the adhishtana of all of these experiences that come into it and go out of it. And so as I realize there's actually, no matter what the experience is that I used to take as me, I'm actually illuminate. And if I recognize there's a subject-object differentiation, when I make that differentiation, then it's like taking off a dress. As I objectify, I'm objectifying the taking off the dress, right? It's just a matter of objectifying. And then I'm with the me that is there. And so in the drishta viveka, the seer-seeing differentiation, I continue to objectify the dress, take off this dress, take off this dress, until there's no dresses left. There's only me. And then I'm not a knower, I'm not knowing anything. In fact, there's nothing there to know. There's just simply me, conscious being, which has, language-wise, is the knownness in every single experience. And so through teaching, and the teaching goes on and on and on and on, but this is a fundamental kind of the beginning step of this teaching, is to recognize my freedom, the asangatvam, that I'm actually not stuck or attached to any experience, and I'm the one who is ever present. Right? That's done, that's gained through vichara, through teaching. And so I recognize that, and then we can do nididhyasana and contemplate on that. and just get to know myself minus these upadis which I had been attached to. So this is what we mean by the vichara. Without that vichara, without knowledge, with self-ignorance, having not done that vichara, there is bondage because what I take myself to be is bound. When the vichara is there, there is freedom because my nature is free. It's not like I'm creating a free me. It's just that is who I am. So it says, by vichara, that bondage is removed. It's removed because it doesn't belong to me. Not doing can't remove something that is there. But knowledge can remove a bondage that is actually false. Right? So therefore, tasmat, therefore, jiva paramatma now, sarvada eva vichariyate. Therefore, you need to always do vichara. You need to expose yourself to this shravana, manana, nididhyasana until there is not a shred of ajnanam left. Until that self-ignorance has been removed. Because the bondage is self-ignorance. The reality is freedom, is moksha. The reality is the paramatma, is the nature of my own being. So the self is ever liberated. It's ever liberated, but the mind experiences it as bound because of the anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition, I've never had a way of breaking that or even a thought of breaking that superimposition. I've never even known it was a superimposition until this teaching takes place. And then it becomes very obvious because the light of knowledge is shining on it, and it's an experiential fact. It's not hypothetical. It's not a philosophy. It's a recognition. And when I have that recognition, there's a tremendous freedom that takes place. Mm-hmm. And once that differentiation is there, then there's so many other things to understand. Like then, where does this body, mind, sense organs that is not fundamentally me, what do I do with it? Where does it exist? You know? What is Ishwara? All of these type of things have to be unfolded. You know? That's also vichara. I'm just giving the start of it. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hare Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hare Om.